Good afternoon and welcome to this month's and this week's Practice as Research Seminar. I'm very delighted, I really am delighted to have you here this afternoon. We are going to have a really, really interesting presentation by Annie McAllister, who is going to focus on voice, authority and truth. And what we've got planned for you today is a presentation, first of all, from Anya. And then we've got another special guest today, and that's Dr. Jenny Louise van der Aar, who is joining us. It's basically giving us an opportunity to have a conversation with Anya about some of the things that she's going to raise. So, trying to introduce you to Anya and our discussant, Dr. Jenny Louise van der Aar. Anya is a member of the Department of Culture, Communication and Media in IOE. And she is working, as you will hear today, about or with ethnopoetics and poetic inquiry. And a lot of her work is to do with marginalized voices, specifically refugees. And she's doing that and has been doing that for quite a while now. So it's really exciting to hear her present from her work. Jenny is a linguistic anthropologist researching education, poverty, language, specifically youth language and migration. So you can see the connections between the two of them. But also Jenny has worked on narrativity. So again, you can see how the two of them are connected. And basically, I think they initially connected over some work by Jan Blommer, but I'm sure we'll hear a little bit more about that later on as well. Jenny's worked with children in Barbados. She's done some social work and poverty research in Antwerp. And she's also been exploring transgenderism and migration trajectories on the Ivory Coast. So again, quite a global sort of influence and experience on Jenny's part. So with that, Anya, I'm going to mute myself. I'm handing over to you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about my work and to represent the voices of the people who I am privileged to work with. So this poetic inquiry and applied ethnopoetic analysis project was seed funded by my department for me to carry out a poetic inquiry project with participants on the ReConnect Preparation for Higher Education program, which is the same name as the charity actually who initiated and fund the program and who do long-standing and fantastic work with refugees and asylum seekers, supporting them into higher education. And on this program, the participants are, as I've just said, refugees, asylum seekers, or forced migrants for whom English is an additional language and also who are highly skilled. And so recognize that that term in itself is problematic, but just to give context, the context that the people on this program are usually often qualified to master's level or beyond, very accomplished professionals, and the impact of the barriers that they face seeking access to higher education and to re-establish themselves professionally and academically at a level which is commensurate with their experience and their accomplishments are often very poignantly evident in their shared experiences on the ReConnect program. And so I carried out this small scale poetic inquiry project to explore with them their experience and to create participant voiced poems. And in doing that, I drew on Jan Blomhardt's applied ethnopoetic work in the field of linguistic ethnography and then applied a process of what I'm calling poetic rendering, taken from Adam Vincent's article in 2018, which he took from Louise Glesner's work from 1997. And I did that so that the participants' voice remained firmly in focus. So I talk about voice, but really my underlying conviction here is that, and I know I'm not alone in this, but I just really wanted to make the point to say that, you know, voice is not given to anybody. I used to talk about poetry giving voice, but, you know, it's not given to anyone. It belongs to everyone from the beginning. And Yusuf Kasmiye, who's a wonderful poet, writing in this field of migration and the experience of the refugee, that's taken from his work in 2018. What I wanted to do was facilitate dialogic conditions which empowered the people that I was talking to and working with in a language in which their voices are largely silent, so to create conditions which facilitate them to perform their own representations and their own analysis of their circumstances, to use applied ethnopoetic analysis to reveal the poetics inherent in the narratives that they critically, as I said, critically, creatively, and reflectively constructed themselves, and then to craft a poetic representation of that analysis. And you know, kind of the approach to dialogue is one Freire in which really recognizes dialogue as an act of creation, in which the world is, as to take from Freire, named by men and women and not on their behalf. And also from my own point of view, that poetry provides insight into the nuances and complexities of culture, and it is the medium through which we can really profoundly echo and share the emotional experience of cultural insiders. I can, you know, really go through the steps in detail of the process of the how of ethnopoetics, because it is a very detailed process which requires patience and attention to detail, in which you step into the dark, and that's to use a Pollock's expression as well. It's not my own. And through that process, narrative emerges. And in the first, it's a cyclical process, the first iteration of which we look for the most obvious markers for line breaks, to break lines, such as subordinate clauses, very obvious changes in tense, obvious repetitions or patterns of equivalence, and also for juxtapositions in units of equivalence. And when the first iteration of that, some impression of where clusters of lines might break into stanzas develops. And this is a feel for stanzas and verses emerging, but we don't separate them yet on that first iteration, and then go back and look for verbs, units of emotion, or verbs of motion. And go back again and again and again to pan for other less obvious markers, such as time markers, to build on already marked units or clusters of lines within a narrative. And then stanzas emerge and are organized then into verses and acts. Let me see. I think next week someone is speaking is going to talk about in the seminar, or not next week, in the next seminar. I'm really looking forward to the talk about taming the inner artist. And for me, this was about resisting the urge, for anyone who writes poems and likes writing poem, to resist that urge to remove anything that you don't think is essential. And the reason why this is really, really important is because narratives don't organize themselves. Narrators organize the contents of their narratives. And the patterns in that organization often indicate a high level of formal skill, sophistication, or what Vandera has called verbal artistry. and to cast those aside and use a prosaic representation of narrative is to not recognize voice. Essentially, what applied ethnopoetic analysis is a means of the recognition of marginalized voices. And in this case, the marginalized voices of refugees and asylum seekers in the context of seeking access to higher education. And I believe that through the process of applied ethnopoetic analysis, that the participant voiced poems that we arrived at eventually reveal not only the voices of the participants, but also the systematic loss of voice that they experience as they seek access to higher education. And what I suggest is that it was that close attention to the inherent poetic patterning and the faithfulness to the participants' organization of their narrative that allowed the revelations that can be seen in those participant voice poems. So let me just talk a little bit about why poetry as research, poetry for research, or poetic inquiry, are recognized as viable, as both a viable research methodology and viable as research output in themselves. You know, lots of people have written about poetry as an output, as a way of expanding the perspective on the human experience and to realize new or different ways of knowing and opening up the space where there's was potential for a variety of views and then a variety of voices. And if we think about how in higher education, sometimes the normative expectations or the expectations about the way in which one expresses oneself mutes voices, then I think it's particularly then allowing different means of representation is very important. And in that respect, it's a form of resistance for the researcher, for the participant, and for the reader to engage in this with this work. It offers the researcher freedom to explore their feelings, but also allows the researcher and the participant together to create an amplifier for voice in society, and it offers the reader other ways of seeing. So I think that I recently read an article about homelessness, poetic inquiry into homelessness, the experience of people who are suffering from homelessness in New Zealand. And I just thought that it applied really well to this project as well. I think that poetry as research or poetic inquiry allows voices on the margins to be heard, and in this context, in an academic setting, allows us to represent and present participants' perspectives in ways that both enfranchise them and add their voices to the discourse. And what was really, really important to me and is really important to me is that I find a way to present data that remains faithful and true and close to the essence, as close as possible to the participants' own representations of their experiences. And so through the process of creating this preliminary output and since creating it, I'm really reflecting on the process by which and the process at which, through critical poetic inquiry, applied ethnopoetic analysis can become the researcher's own poetic response to qualitative research data. And in my process, it's elicited first through dialogue, then through ethnopoetic analysis, and then through a process of poetic rendering. And so I think it's a really, so Maynard and Kamen talk about a continuum. In 2010 article, they talk about a continuum of poetic ethnography, ethnopoetics, and ethnographic poetry. And I would place this work at between the second two points on that continuum. And what I'm really interested in is exploring that place, that intersection. And I just have made some notes here about, you know, applied ethnopoetics. Every word counts in the pursuit of the truth, and we uncover rich complexity in the detail, and paying attention to the patterning of words and lines is absolutely paramount, because in doing that we uncover the overall structure of a narrative. And Virginia Hines, who was Del Hines, from whom Jan Blomhart, whose work on ethnopoetics focused on the oral traditions and folklore of Native Americans, he applied it to the narratives of asylum seekers and refugees in Belgium. So this pattern of onset on the onset of a narrative, the ongoing narrative and the outcome of a narrative, Virginia Hines and Del Hines talked about this in the first instance being apparent in myth and non-myth narrative and in conversational anecdote. And then on the other hand, we can see differences and comparisons between that and poetry. In your own poetry, some words are superfluous to the search for truth, whereas in applied ethnopoetics, we're attempting to reveal complexity and detail. Through poetry, we're trying to foster depth and simplicity and intensity. And it's not just the patterning of words, but also the space between words, how we arrange words, the silence that we can create on the page to is also very important. And we're not so much, even in narrative poetry, we're not so much concerned with the overall structure of our narrative, but more with that preoccupation with show, don't tell, finding the truth, the pursuit of truth, but in doing so, tell it slant, to use Emily Dickinson, to draw on the oft-drawn on Emily Dickinson quote. So we might be less concerned with the onset of the narrative and more concerned with finding the line or the image that will draw the reader in, and of course our approach to how we view the outcome or seek to represent the resolution will be different as well. And the other thing that that I've been reflecting on here very quickly is authority, authorship and ownership. And I think if we're using applied ethnopoetic analysis as a way to make visible the epistemic knowledge of voices that are vulnerable, then we must also recognize the claim to ownership of knowledge that is produced and that is constructed. And we have to think about how these concepts are linked to voice. And of course that involves questions around, ethical questions around anonymity or not, and how far the text moves away from the participant's contribution to the knowledge that was constructed when we're deciding who the author is. And those are concerns that I'm really ethically, really want to explore from an ethical point of view. Just to end by saying that if we want to use this distillation process as a way to remain close to reveal and to amplify the truths of marginalized voices, then these are concepts that we need to really closely consider as well. We need to acknowledge the tension as we move along that continuum, and I would suggest that in combination, these methods are viable for revealing voice and representing truthfully the experience of the and knowledge of the otherwise marginalized and silenced.
Thank you very much, Anya. Thank you. You get a round of applause from me, some virtual applause I can already see as well. So thank you very much. It would be really helpful if you could stop sharing your screen. Thanks. Fabulous. Please, everyone, do pitch in with questions and comments. I know that Jenny and I, we've kind of, you know, like had a sneak preview of what was going to happen. So we do have some questions already prepared as well for Anya. The first one I would like to start with is, you know, why do poetic inquiry in the first place? Why bother with a distillation process when we can do thematic analysis, for example? So please, Anya, why that?
Well, I think, so the first thing to say is that one doesn't preclude the other. You know, they're people engaged in poetic inquiry or poetry as research do also engage in thematic analysis, some before. So that the article that I referred to earlier about homelessness in New Zealand by Carol et al., they do thematic analysis before they create the poetic representations. In my approach, in this approach, which we'll call a distillation process, the thematic analysis will occur after the applied ethnopoetic analysis and the poetic rendering, precisely because of what I've said earlier about the revelation of voice. There's another article that I'd like to draw your attention to. Actually, it's really interesting, and it's by Camilla Davis, and it samples cultural or poetic pedagogy as well. And I think, and she analyzes voice as part of her poetic inquiry process, not voice in the linguistic sense, but she does thematic analysis, but also analyzes voice in terms of cadence and rhythm and sound, and it's really interesting. So and combines that with thematic analysis. But there are, not to ramble on too much, but there are poetic inquirers who don't think that further thematic analysis is necessary. There are some that do and there are some that don't. So in terms of why I would be happy eventually to work without that additional thematic analysis is because of, you know, the kind of profound emotional engagement that poetry allows, and how, as I've said, it allows us to remain close to the participants' voice and the participants' perspective. And I think just as an ethical approach, it recognizes agency and it recognizes participants' voices and moves away from them as objective, as data sources. And also because poetry in itself allows for multiple meanings, a multiplicity of interpretation. And then, of course, my own love of poetry and the joy, the joy that comes from paying attention to that form, the musicality, rhythm, line breaks, space, syntax, just being involved in that process.
Thank you. I think some of what you've just saying is really really connect with what people have also been saying. So there's somebody here who says, you know, how do you feel about song as opposed to spoken voice, for example?
Okay. I find, so that's something that I hope to explore next. I've just had some really interesting conversations I've collaborated with a composer before, and I hope to collaborate again to develop a critical poetic inquiry module to explore with refugees and asylum seekers their experience of seeking home, and then to allow the composer to work collaboratively with the participants to set that their words to song. And I'm really interested in exploring that as the public performance of that song, that choral representation, as a means of knowledge production.
Thank you very much. So we've got a couple of virtual hands up. So can we ask the first person, I hope it's okay to name you, Sarah Young?
Yeah, that's fine. Hi, thanks for such a really interesting presentation. There's two things I just want to ask, because I come from linguistics, my interest is to do with when you're analysing the poetry, how much do you take into consideration the language in terms of, firstly, the English additional language speakers, so that will have an influence, I imagine, on the words that they're using, the syntax they're using, even the tense, for example. And also, how much are they drawing, whether it's subconsciously or consciously, on the poetic traditions in their own language or languages? And how much, I'm not saying that everything needs to be covered, but how much of that is taken into consideration when they're undergoing analysis?
Okay, so I think that what you said about recognizing the I'm going to ask Jenny to come in on this as well, because I think that she's got, you know, she's, for want of a better expression, really hardcore ethno-poetic analyst, and I'm further along the continuum to poetic inquiry. So my kind of interest goes back as far as a Blomhartian application of ethno-poetic analysis. And also then Jenny's work is connected to that as well. But I think the point that you make about English being a second language and coming from a linguist's perspective, it's ethnopoetic analysis is applied ethnopoetic analysis is really about recognizing the inequalities that exist and that people are subjected to because of difference in their language repertoires. So the fact that people are sometimes using the wrong tense or maybe not using conventional grammatical constructions, and they're not using normative, not meeting normative expectations, freezes their voice. I can't remember the Blomhartian quote exactly, but it is by paying attention only to whether or not people are meeting conventional expectations, and not looking at the inherent underlying poetic features of their narrative, of their architectures, that we silence them, applied ethno-poetic analysis allows us to look below that, and I suppose that's connected to your second point as well about recognizing the kind of cultural aspects of or language architecture, language construction. Applied ethno-poetic analysis allows us to recognize that, allows us to reveal it, and allows us to recognize the verbal artistry in it. And also recognizes that while I did say earlier that narrators organize their narratives, it doesn't just happen by accident. And so we need to recognize that. There is, of course, some unconscious patterning that is culturally informed. And I think that by using applied ethnopoetic analysis, we can pay attention to that and gain cultural understanding and appreciation.
I think that one of the points that Jan Blomhart made in his work was that ethnopoetics pays specifically attention to the cultural dimension of narration, which is something we call tradition. Which is basically, if you define tradition, the performable stock of culture or repertoire you could say, so that we could take a look at repertoire by taking a look at the second layer of narratives, which basically comes out in its patterning, so that there, that cultural level, that cultural layer is really, really demonstrated. Himes, I believe, used words such as use all there is to use. So thematic analysis does not exclude that more deeper kind of understanding of sociolinguistic structures. And therefore, I want to also thank Oyne, because she already put that very clearly in her presentation, which is a very hard methodological tool to grasp ethnopoetics anyway, Oyne. So I want to congratulate you on a magnificent attempt to sort of explain to us the intricacies of such endeavor. But that's what it really does. It brings out those cultural linguistic second layer patterns, which then can be used to understanding voice. What is voice other than being heard on your own terms?
You're on mute, Anya, you're on mute.
Just with regard, so my mind is drawn to the Virginia Himes chapter that actually, Jenny, you put me onto, and that I read. And she in analyzing the narratives from a class which she run called Ways of Speaking, she uncovered the use of the emphatic or the emphatic use of the demonstrative pronoun as a marker for breaking up the clustering of lines. And she then went back to and the same feature is not used in the I can't remember the name of the language that she the other language that she was oral language that she was analyzing, but she identified something similar that to connect the two languages, so that the same and identified a common pattern or a common device that was used across different languages, and you might find that very interesting to read.
Yeah, thank you. I will.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So I've got another virtual hand up. I would like to bring in Babs, please.
Hi, hello. So thank you so much. That was really interesting. And in terms of I have a couple of questions. So in terms of the pamphlet, has that been produced solely in English, or has that been made available to the sort of languages of the participants? Because I can sort of imagine that, you know, in Arabic or Pashto or Farsi, and not only reading it, but I would love to know if there are audio recordings that are available.
Anya, you're on mute again.
Thank you so much for that question. No, it has not been made available in other languages yet. But you can find it on UCL Discovery, or if you just Google Seeking Access Oyne McAllister, you'll see that the participants are co-named as authors. And the next output, which I hope to realize, is an exhibition in which the participants will also be co-owners of that. And as part of that, will potentially be recording vocal or audio recordings as a digital aspect of the exhibition.
That sounds amazing. I think I'm going to say that horrible line. This is not a question, but just a comment from my own experience. So I carried out my research during lockdown while shielding a daughter with complex disabilities. And cognitively, I found that creating poems from the data was actually really beneficial to me when I was experiencing sort of severe sort of brain fog and things. And it actually distilled a lot of the ideas. Now, unfortunately, the field that I'm working in, translation studies, poetic inquiry is not a thing. And it's really difficult to try and introduce something that's not a thing, although I'm trying as hard as I can. It has been suggested that, you know, the poems are great, but maybe for an article, not the thesis or the appendix. which I'm really quite sad about, because the one participant who is a literary translator, it was a case study, who is going to be named. I see her as a co-author, you know, in this work, and I sent her the poems and she just loved them, you know. But basically these were her words, but then I started, I don't know what happens in this sort of cognitive process when you're looking at the sort of data and the participants' words and you're writing, and then all of a sudden it sort of, it was a really generative process, and a lot of what was generated during the sort of poem writing has now found its way into the thesis. So I think it should be encouraged, even if disciplines are, you know, it's new in the discipline and they're a bit, perhaps not. I think it should be encouraged in terms of being part of a process, because thesis writing is often seen as being something to be endured. Whereas if we can inject some joy and pleasure and playfulness, I think Sarah Huxley, who's here today, who's a poet and a doctoral researcher probably agrees. And she's one of my inspirations and part of, you know, what I'm doing now. So just want to say this is a complete delight and a joy to be here. And I look forward to looking into your project more and seeing how it develops. So thank you from Babs.
Barbara, please, is it Babs?
It is Babs, yeah.
I can put my email address in chat, and I'd love to connect with you to talk about that. I think if you work in translation studies, then applied ethnopoetic analysis might be something that you know, because of it's looking for equivalence and it's looking for parallelisms, and part of that is connected to, I might be completely wrong, but I think it's connected to your field. So there might be some bridge that you can build there, which is what the reason I was looking for a way to make sure that my output could stand up to rigor or to questions about validity and rigor. And I think that, you know, ethnopoetic analysis, that is something that I did want to say today, that this is something that we all, you know, that anyone who's engaged in poetic inquiry, I think we're all struggling with that. Nicole, you will probably have lots to say about that as well. But another article that I can draw your attention to is by Maynard. It's a 2009 article, so, you know, it's from a while ago. But he talks about ethnographic poetry being, he used doubly challenged to be both artful and well-crafted verse, but also attaining validity. And I feel that this process, this distillation process, which includes ethnopoetic analysis, applied ethnopoetic analysis, is my way to achieve that validity, so that you know, we can respond to claims about, well, that your poem is very nice, but perhaps put it in the appendix.
Yeah, exactly. And if I may add, there are many, many people who are now interested in thesis formats that are very different from the traditional monograph, right? I'm actually supervising a student, PhD student myself, who is doing her thesis entirely in poetry and ethnographic poetry. And there is this wonderful booklet which came out by Multilingual Matters by Adrian Blackledge and Angela Kreese on ethnographic drama. And they've actually studied an interpreter's bureau for Chinese workers in London and have put this into a theater piece. So they've made their fieldwork into a theater piece with a small Bourdieuan direction quotes underneath and so on. So it's really fantastic work that's happening right now in the form of monographs, theses and so on. Also, the journal Anthropology and Humanism has been publishing ethnographic poetry for many, many decades. So we have this validity, we have this pedigree on which we can build. And people tell you, Anya, that, you know, this is not something you should put in the main body. There is tons of work that we can now refer them to, and that are, you know, our foremothers and fathers that, you know, have been doing this work. So there's absolutely a degree of pedigree there.
Yeah. And also there's a movement, isn't there? You know, because I, you know, what if we ask ourselves, what does the expectation that all representations of knowledge must be in a form, in the conventional academic form, do and say? And then on the other hand, what does allowing space for poetic representation, for example, allow for? What does it, what's the impact on the knowledge that is produced, to shared understanding, to how meaning is made? And, you know, what are we saying about meanings that matter? That's from an MFL report from many, many years ago. But by allowing different ways for knowledge to be produced and represented, you know, we're allowing many more different meanings to matter.
Well, in many ways, that's also one of the reasons why we've established this practice as a research network, because we found that so many of us doing things that don't necessarily fit within the traditions of traditional, conventional kind of work. And we see practice in different ways. And some of us, like you do, ethnopoetic analysis or poetic inquiry. Other people may be working with drama, like Jenny was talking about. Other people, again, may be doing teaching practice or nursing practice. So there's all sort of geography practices and architectural practices, and all of those things are actually making it really, really difficult to fit within the conventions. I have got one virtual hand up, and I've also got a question in the chat box. Anya, keep yourself brief. Question in the chat box: I use the listening guide, which uses an I poem to look at possible co-occurring voices. The process involves explicitly examining your own subjectivities. Is this something that you have addressed? And how did you go about this, if you did?
So my, immediately I think of autoethnography and how that it's looking at through the lens of the self allows us to understand, you know, greater cultural phenomena. And that's really key, central to my critical pedagogical practice, where I use autoethnographic poetic inquiry as a critical pedagogical tool to with my students who are refugees and asylum seekers, because it centers, valorizes their voice and you know, that is absolute, and their knowledge and their perspectives. So I think that that's a really, there's a lot to read and a lot to think and a lot to say about autoethnography and looking through the I and the self.
Thank you, Anya. And I have got one virtual hand up. Would you like to come in now?
Great. Hi, thank you so much, Anya. This is incredibly rich. I'm not well versed in ethnopoetics, so apologies if I've slightly misunderstood, but I was just thinking around the kind of the holistic methodology of the research. And on one hand, I could see that, as I was understanding ethnopoetic, it seems to bring a very rational, structured and disciplined, quite a normative method in some way of being an approach to research. So it's kind of the structure. But it's interested in the non-rational and the emotional and the affective ways of generating and creating research. So I was kind of reflecting on, is that problematic in relation to the epistemology, or is it actually something that's acutely and painfully truthful about the nature of research and particularly qualitative research?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question, and really, I'd love to have another hour to explore it. And that's something that Jenny and I were talking about recently. But the way I think there's a similarity the comment and the insight that you've just brought to Jenny's question about whether the meticulous attention that's required for applied ethnopoetic analysis takes away from the kind of political imperative of applied ethnopoetic analysis, which is to bring the narrator to the fore in the narrative. So yes, I do think that it's kind of rigid in that it's a painstaking attention to detail is necessary. But I think that it's in that attention to detail that you in many ways that's similar to my approach to writing poetry, because one needs to really pay attention to the kind of crafting the work, and every word matters really in order to what you're going to leave at the end. So I can see where the tension lies, but I don't think that they're still sympathetic with each other, and I think one enhances the other.
I absolutely love that response, thank you. And I love the focus on attentiveness, actually pulling the potential binaries together. Thank you, that's very helpful.
Again, it would be great to talk more, Sarah, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much. Jenny?
Yeah, moreover, I do agree with Onye that the ethnopoetic analysis brings out structures in a different epistemology than the epistemology of the person that you are in conversation with. For example, in the asylum-seeking interviews, the asylum commissar works in a very quick succession of question and answer frames. Are you from Liberia? Yes. How many children do you have? Three. What's the seven last presidents of Liberia? I mean, I can't name the last seven presidents of or kings of Belgium, so to speak. So it's a very hard kind of thing to do for refugees. And they operate in a different epistemology, which is not so much truth-seeking, but which is explanatory, right? And ethnopoetics just wants to bring out that particular epistemology of the voice of the participant that is usually, you know, suppressed or not heard or something like that. And I think that what I've been recently exploring and addressing in an article is the work of Raymond Williams on structures of feeling, and try to link the kind of verbs of emotion to reflecting on structures of feeling in the kind of ethnopoetic transcript as another layer, adding it on as another layer, actually. So I'm very pleased with your question, Sarah, because this is really something that we can't ignore. We should remain within the epistemology of the persons that we work with, the persons that we study, the persons that we engage with, and so on. So yeah, thank you again.
I totally agree with what you both were saying. I would just like to add, often, because we had this conversation earlier where people were saying, you know, the creative stuff goes into the appendix and it's not valued in that same way. I think what the reason why that is because a lot of the time people don't see that this is proper research. They see that as something that we do that's a little bit fancy and a little bit out there in a way. But in my view, that kind of work is actually more honest, because you are transparent about bringing out specific elements of what you're doing. A lot of the research that we see, and a lot of the research reports that we see, are talking about, you know, these themes have emerged. Well, there is no real recognition that actually, you know, they don't just pop up. It's something that we do to the data and with the data. And by actually engaging with that creative process, we are quite transparent about how we, you know, navigate the data and manipulate aspects of it. And we still do that systematically, which basically means that is where the rigor and the validity then come in, like Anya was saying earlier. So I do see that we have to perhaps just learn as a group of people, just learn to be a little bit more confident in the kind of work that we do. And rather than, you know, letting other people tell us to stick it into the appendix, to actually say, you know what, this is not the appendix, this is the thing. And sometimes, yes, I know from my personal experiences that that is hard to do, but especially when you negotiate with academic journals, where you're trying to put a picture and they say, well, that's supplementary material, and you go, no, actually it's not, this is the thing, it's not supplementary material. You know, all of these conversations are to be had all the time, but I think we just need to, as a group of people, we just need to learn to be confident learned that what we do counts, is valid, is important, and we are being transparent. And that by doing that, we will actually gain that kind of trajectory that we want in the long term.
Yeah, and perhaps start our own journal if people don't want to accept the...
to be honest...
Our working paper series, who knows? We've done that with Jan Jenny, in Tilburg. Yeah,
Jenny, you're kind of, a few weeks behind because the book series proposal is already in with publishers. It's already happening. The revolution
great.
Is already happening.
The revolution has started without me.
I think that we've talked about this a lot, Nicole, about questioning or allowing a discussion about what is research, what constitutes research, what it constitutes knowledge, and the kind of tyranny of the scientific approach. We don't necessarily have to prove, I think, that an output is scientific in order for it to be viable. But I do think that applied ethnopoetic analysis for me, and it does offer me a magnifying glass, and to really focus on the perspectives of the people that I'm talking to, and then the poetic rendering of it creates a greater focus again. Then,
thank you very much, Anya. I think that's a very, very good way to conclude today's session. I'm quite conscious of the time. I want to make sure that we are not losing anybody's because people have to rush off. Jenny, would you like to say a few sort of last words?
Yes, I want to thank everyone a lot for these very inspiring comments. I'm very happy that the revolution has started. And I'll be happy to join that.
Perfect.
The rest has been history, I think. I have to go because my cab is there. So I'll see you guys later.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jenny. Thank you much for your contribution.
So I would like everyone. To also say thank you very much to Jenny and Anya for presenting today. And I'm already giving you a heads up for the next session, which is going to happen on the first Wednesday in December, which is the 1st of December. And we will be having Dr. Agata Lulkowska talking about Taming Your Inner Artist, Challenges of Creative Practice-Based Research. Agata is working within film, predominantly, and photography. So it's a slightly different artistic practice, but obviously it's still within the same realm of practice as research. So you may be finding that quite interesting. Also, I would like to give you a heads up on the Practice as Research Network. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel to catch up with any sessions that you may miss because you can't attend. We've also got this video recorded, and that will be made available as an audio on Buzzsprout, or it can be listened to as an audio podcast on Spotify as well. And there's also the Practice as Research website, where there's all the news and information and newsletters. And you can obviously get in touch with me on my email address as well, but you can also email or contact me through the website to be put on the mailing list if you're not on there yet. And finally, I'd like to say, for those of, because obviously today was the focus about poetic inquiry and poetry work, do get in touch with Anya and me. Both of us are running an evening at the moment, which we are going to move into afternoons and mornings for the spring and summer term, where we are basically working and sharing poetic work as a group of poetry as research. So if you would like to find out more, please do get in touch. Anya, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time today. And I look forward to seeing everybody next time again. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been such a privilege, as is the work. So thank you.